Renee and Georgette Magritte with their dog after the war return to their hotel suite and they unlock the door. Easily losing their evening clothes, they dance by the light of the moon to the penguins. The moon glows, the orioles and the five satins, the deep forbidden music they've been longing for. Renee and Georgette Magritte with their dog after the war.
That, my friends, is a masterpiece. Renee and Georgette Magritte with their dog after the war by Paul Simon. I'm Tom Hall. Welcome back to Midday. The Baltimore Museum of Art has a bunch of masterpieces collected together in its new show, including a few by the great surrealist Rene Magritte, one of the subjects of the photograph that inspired Paul Simon's beautiful song. The show is called Monsters and Myths, Surrealism and War in the 1930s and 1940s. Oliver Schell is Associate Curator of European Painting and Sculpture at the BMA, and he's curated this terrific exhibition with a colleague from Connecticut, and he joins me here in Studio A. It's good to see you.
Nice to see you again.
So when people think of the word surreal, you know, it's bizarre or unusual or wacky. How did that term come to be connected to the artistic and literary movement of the 20s, 30s, and 40s?
Well, the term was actually coined by a pre-surrealist named Guillaume Apollinaire, a poet, a friend of Picasso's in that circle. And it was sort of revived by André Breton, the founder of surrealism, in 1924 when he wrote his Manifesto of Surrealism.
So there was a guy who started it, André Breton.
Pretty much,
and
yes.
And he wrote a manifesto that said, we hereby declare ourselves
surrealists. Pretty much, that he had certain principles and a quite formal definition of what it meant to be a surrealist. And it really was about exploring the unconscious without any filters, without any self-censorship, and finding different avenues for accessing the subconscious or the unconscious mind.
Yeah, and Breton said that surrealism can be understood historically only in relation to the war. He said that in a speech in New Haven, Connecticut in the 1940s. What does that mean? What's that relation, and why is it important to understand surrealism in that context?
Well, both André Breton and his fellow surrealists were part of a generation that began their youth with the backdrop of World War I, and many of them actually fought in that war and were injured in that war, and he himself was a medic of sorts, just behind the lines.
So the is war sort of the overarching patina that everybody is working in? I mean, is it related to, you know, anti-war sentiment? I mean, are the paintings and sculptures and literary work of the time, is it directly commenting on the evils of war?
Well, I mean, they came out of this First World War. Most of them were profoundly anti-patriotic. They were, there were an international bunch of people, artists from Germany, from France, and elsewhere getting together, and they were a revolutionary movement. They believed that the Russian Revolution had shown the way that one could topple old and obsolete regimes, and they wanted a kind of spiritual and psychic revolution. And then they discovered somewhere in the early 30s, to their great consternation and disappointment, that the world was headed the other way.
Because this is the rise of fascism.
The rise of fascism across Europe. I mean, Hitler becomes chancellor in 1933. That's the same year that they found their journal Minotaur, which is the whole name of the journal is already a monster, and it evokes monsters basically.
One thing that people, art historians like you, have long noticed about the style of surrealism is that there are often kind of irrational juxtapositions of various images. So you'll see, you know, canvases that are filled with, you know, all these things that at first glance don't seem to connect in any particular way. When you were putting this show together, there's over 90 works. There's a lot of stuff in this show. How did you, is the importance of juxtaposition in terms of where you put each painting on the wall and where you put each piece of sculpture in the galleries, was that a something that was a difficult determination to make?
That was almost too clever for me. I just went with chronology, basically starting with the works that were from the early 30s and grouping them, and occasionally with a thematic section. I have a section that dramatically called Monsters of the Flesh, which examines the way the surrealists used the human body as sort of and distortion of the human body as an expressive means. But what you say about juxtaposition is really true, especially of an earlier phase when they were following this dictum of a poet named L'Autrement, which is kept talking about the meeting on an operating table of an umbrella and a sewing machine. Just total absurdities.
Yeah. Why do you juxtapose the notions of monsters and myths? Where does that come from?
Well, a lot of the myths that became central, such as the Minotaur myth, involved a large monster. And what monsters were is constantly shifting, whether they are sort of counter creatures to fight off monsters, or whether they are just trying to understand where in the human psyche that monstrous element lay.
And in one of the essays in the catalog, which is stunning for this very stunning exhibition, you ask the question, what constitutes monstrousness? And it's interesting that the artists depict it in both very extreme ways and also very subtle and not at all extreme ways.
That is kind of amazing about surrealism, is there's no one style, and artists are constantly exploring different things. The monstrous can be something, you know, quite subtle. Just thinking of a Dora Maar photograph in the show, of just these wrapped up statues where you only see like little bits of the feet coming out from underneath the bag, and there's something monstrous about that in its own way. And others are quite explicit, you know, actual depictions of monsters with fangs and whatnot.
So I mentioned there are like 90 masterpieces between the mid-30s and the mid-40s. Big-time A-list names, Dalí, Picasso, Miró, Magritte, Masson, the list goes on and on. How difficult was it to assemble all these big A-list paintings?
Well, that was one of the reasons we sought a collaboration with Hartford, with the Wadsworth Athenaeum, because we have a donor, Sadie Adler May, who gave us a wonderful collection of Miró's and of André Masson's, an artist whom she knew personally and whose family she helped during the war. But the Wadsworth has a great collection of Max Ernst and Dalí. So you put those together, those are really the key figures around André Breton in the visual aspect of surrealism.
So the way it works is it's here on display in Baltimore, and then does the whole thing move to Hartford?
It actually started in
Hartford. Started there.
It started there in the fall and finished in January. And from us this summer, it's going to go to the Frist Art Museum in Nashville.
Yeah. I would imagine it was highly well attended in Hartford.
I haven't got the full numbers, but I believe at the end there was quite a crush.
Yeah. Is there a piece in this 90-plus, exhibition, the 90-piece-plus exhibition that strikes you as your fave?
Well, it seems like again and again, Dali's soft construction with boiled beans gets singled out because he's such a master.
And it's an enormous painting.
It's actually even not our biggest painting, but it seems the most enormous painting because it gets used by our various graphic people for advertising and for other things, so it's often repeated. I certainly love Max Ernst's Europe After the Rain 2 just as much, a phenomenal work with...
I mean, the Salvador Dalí painting is very much a response to the Spanish Civil War, which happened in the mid-30s.
Yeah, he calls it a premonition of the Spanish Civil War, and he actually finished it 2 months before the war broke out, so he appeared even more to be sort of a seer of the future.
What was the movement widely accepted? Was it ridiculed? I mean, were people in the 30s saying to Dolly, look, you're an artist, you know, get your nose out of these geopolitical affairs? Or how were they received?
I don't know. Dolly was actually one of the least political of the artists. He was quite ambivalent about the Spanish Civil War. It had killed one of his close friends, Federico Lorca, the Spanish poet who was murdered in 1936 by the fascist forces. But they'd also the Republican forces had also harassed his sister. So he was not on any one clear side.
Yeah, interesting stuff. Oliver Schell, he's the curator of the new exhibition at the Baltimore Museum of Art called Monsters and Myths, Surrealism and War in the 1930s and 40s. It opens on Sunday, and it'll be at the BMA until the end of May. Thanks, Oliver, and congratulations on the show.
Thank you very much.
That's it for us today. Coming up Monday, pollster Malia Cromer from the Sarah T. Hughes Field Center for Politics joins me to talk about their latest poll. We'll see what Marylanders had to say about issues like the $15 minimum wage, legalizing recreational marijuana, and banning styrofoam products. Plus, a new report by the Abel Foundation looks around the country to explore consolidation of local governments. Are there examples that perhaps would inform our local policy? For example, should Baltimore City and Baltimore County merge? We'll talk about it Monday on Midday. Thanks to Bottoms Up Bagels for providing lunch today. Bottoms Up Bagels is a small-batch pop-up bagel shop preparing hand-rolled New Jersey-style bagels, house-cured lox, and specialty cream cheeses inspired by traditions of bagel making dating back to the 1940s. Bottoms Up Bagels offers customized catering packages of all kinds. You can find them at the Waverly Farmers Market and online at bottomsupbagels.com. Midday's director and engineer is Luke Spicknell. We want to thank Mac Taka and Katie Marquette for helping us out this week, and we hope, Luke, that you're feeling better soon. Rob Sivak, Sienna Greaves, and Kathleen Cahill produce the program. Jamila Krempel is WIPR's digital producer. Austin Coughlin from Clean Cuts wrote and recorded the Midday theme music. Our interns are Morgan Ome and Abba Amoa. A program note for a thing that's happening tonight at 7 o'clock at Red Emma's Bookstore. That's on Cathedral Street across from the Meyerhof. There's a Catholic Worker reading. Dave Eberhardt, Brendan Walsh, and Willa Bickham will share some of their poetry and excerpts from their books tonight at Red Emma's at 7 o'clock. We are, of course, keeping on top of the situation involving Elizabeth McAllister, another Catholic worker who's currently in prison. We'll see you on Monday. Thanks for being with us. Take care.
This is your public radio, 88.1 WYPR.